Jesus,
that was horrible. All
right, 10,
all right.
9,
8, 7.
Oh, Luke, why don't you just go with, let's go with actual seconds, okay? All right, 10,
okay.
9, 8,
7,
6,
5,
4,
3,
Two. Welcome back to the show, Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast. I'm your host, Alan Keith, and I'm talking to Luke Murphy, who doesn't have the courtesy to introduce himself.
Oh yes, my name's Luke Murphy, and we are recording live, but you'll probably get it in a recorded format. So
that's not interrupted. What is that? What was that noise?
Nothing.
Okay.
The microphone fell over.
It's been a while since we've been able to record.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, and for those of you listeners, I believe we left off with talking about the Solon reforms. I believe we went over a lot of those reforms. And just to recap, I think a lot of those reforms were geared towards resetting Rome to its aristocratic state before the Civil War. So, really, Sulla wanted to implement these reforms so that there couldn't be another Marius to prevent the Senate from electing a Metelli or a Sulla to a position of power.
And I mean, it seems to be Sulla was really trying to, it's almost as if he had a Roman history book in his hands and he was trying to set back the clock. You know, we do have the reforms pretty well spelled out.
Yeah, which I don't think is unreasonable. I also think that we really have to remember, too, that he had a vested interest in, ensuring his legitimacy. And I think a large part of his legitimacy was through the Metelli family, who was basically at odds with Marius. If we recall, Marius had basically usurped the Jugurthine War out of the hands of Metellus Numidicus, and then made a further name for himself in the north with the Teutons and the Cimbri. But really, you see in the Jugurthine War a split where Marius starts using the populace and the popular will to really go against the aristocracy. So Sulla really has a vested interest in solidifying his allegiance with the Metelli, and a large part of that is implementing a lot of these reforms that's going to strengthen the Metelli family. You know, because it was, Marius did definitely deal it a significant blow, and the Marian forces definitely dealt the Metelli family a significant blow. To not only their reputation, but just to the family as a whole. And, you know, the one thing that I think is important here too is to look at, you know, what was going on with Pompey at the time. Pompey the Great, obviously, he was almost a wild card. He almost came from nowhere during, the Civil War. You know, Sulla didn't know when he arrived in Italy whether he was going to have to fight with Pompey or welcome as a friend. He really had no clue of what Pompey was going to do. Pompey had a large force behind him. I think it was three legions. He had three legions when Sulla arrived in Italy. And the only other person that really could help him was Metellius Pius, who was in the south and who allied with him. And so you have really the Metelli under Metellus Pius, you had Pompey, and you had Sulla. And that was the original kind of pre-triumvirate, I would say, that's going to foreshadow some of these other political connections. But really, when you look at that triumvirate, Pompey is he's almost on a position outside of that mainstream. I mean, he marries into the Metelli family, at Sulla's will. Obviously, Caesar, does not follow Sulla's wish to, or Sulla's demand that he divorce his wife, which is an interesting split between, I think, where we see Pompey and Sulla. I think Pompey is being sort of christened into the establishment, if you will, of Rome at this time.
You cut out there. Were you talking about Julius Caesar being forced to divorce his wife in 81 BC?
Yes. Yeah. I was saying that it's interesting to see the differences between Pompey, divorcing his wife and marrying into the Metelli family, and Caesar not divorcing his wife. Who's obviously part of the Marian, family, apparatus. I mean, her father, Caesar's wife's father, was one of the judges. I forget his name off the top of my head, but so his wife was definitely connected with the Marian cause through blood relation.
We talked in a few other episodes ago that Pompey was compelled to enter into a marriage alliance with the Solon faction, and he readily divorced his wife Antistia. Yeah. And he readily divorced his wife when he had the opportunity for a political match with the Solon faction.
Yeah, which was basically the Metelli family.
Yes.
Because he marries into the Metelli family. And, but I think it's also interesting to note, he basically becomes the thrall of Sulla. So Pompey ends up going to Sicily, and, he ends up murdering Carbo and a number of other people, and earning the nickname, the Carnifex Adolescence, the juvenile butcher, the adolescent butcher. So he basically gets this name because it almost seems as something bizarre, because if you remember, Carbo was a consul, he was a consul at the time, and Sulla has him brought before him in chains. Basically Carbo is pissing himself. Pompey deals with him harshly, as is as we see Sulla does with all of his enemies. If you really look at what Sulla did during his proscriptions, he murdered 90 senators. He murdered 15 men of consular rank. So those are men that could hold the highest position, in Rome. He murdered 15 of them. It'd be the equivalent of Donald Trump murdering the next 15 other people that could possibly run for president. That's how severe it would be. And he also liquidated 2,600 knights. He murdered so many people that he could walk around unguarded in the forum with his friends. I mean, think about that. Like, he murdered so many people that after the Civil War, he didn't have to be guarded. Like, it was complete and absolute.
Yeah. The huge number of knights that get eradicated in these proscriptions, if the podcast ever continues to the so-called Second Triumvirate with Lepidus, Mark Antony, and Octavian, we see a huge, exuberant number of knights being massacred in these prescriptions. We have discussed in these podcasts, I feel like I say that all the time, they had a considerable amount of political influence and economic leverage over the economy and the government of Rome. I kind of think of the knights at this point, and they've been in the power now for a few decades, but I like to think of them kind of as the capitalist lobbyist of our own government. They may not be writing legislation, they may not be in office, but their influence over those in power cannot be underestimated. Obviously, they're going to be
that they held serious courts. They held serious influence over the judicial branch, and I think that was one of the problems, because you know, these knights now had, you know, increasingly power to convict people, whether the charges were real or not. You know, they could just drum up any charges and then have someone exiled. And so it was a considerable power if you're trying to go against the business interests in Rome at this time. It's considerably dangerous.
And I do want to defend Pompey, but going back to what you said about the kid butcher, we're going to see in today's episode, episode 6, when we deal with the Lepidus affair, he does put Marcus Brutus, who's the father of the conspirator, Junius Brutus, he does put him to death, which isn't going to help his reputation as the butcher boy, as it were. But when he put Carbo to death, you know, there really was not another option that he could have done. Could he have sent him back to Rome in chains? Could he kept him prisoner? He was really acting under Sulla's orders, and there was no scenario where Carbo would have gotten out of that with his life. And you cited in the last episode, Pompey showing a lot of clemency towards people, and a lot of the historical sources are telling us that he let a lot of people go when he could, even a lot of people who were political influences in Rome. You know, he did spare people when he reasonably could, and we're going to see more of that when he, after his conquest of Spain in a couple episodes. You know, I don't know how much, my point is, I don't know how much, the butcher boy, I don't know how much of that is really an earned reputation or how much of that is just more black propaganda, you know. And this is an age where mudslinging was a political tool. I mean, you know, character witnesses were extremely important in trial. It was completely acceptable to say the most horrible things about your political opponents in court, out of court, and that was just expected. That was, you know, the way of
the world. A lot of it wasn't really based on evidence per se. It was based more on character witnesses, you know, what the people said about your character, what kind of reputation you had. So your reputation was really important. I also think Sulla, you know, he wanted people to fear him. To the point where he had no fear of, you know, any kind of retaliation because of what kind of horror he could bring down. You know, the proscriptions, I don't think it can be understated how insane they were. I mean, you had people, basically he started this proscription list, and I don't know if we went through it in the last time, but it was basically a list of people, who were suspected of being against the Roman state, and increasingly people ended up getting put on the list because of their financial situation. Because, you know, if you were part of the Marian cause, or even if you weren't, even if you just had something that somebody wanted, your name might end up on the list, you know, because Saul is building favors. You know, he wasn't just getting revenge against the Marians and suppressing the Marians. He was also putting people on there to murder them because of their estate, or murder them because of their holdings. And then he'd give those holdings to someone like, say, Crassus, or, you know, allow them to buy them dirt cheap. And really you start seeing two sort of people emerge. You start seeing the people that are really benefiting from the Solon cause, rise to the top, and you start seeing the people that are, really victims to this force that's in Rome that's murdering people for their goods, you know, start becoming extremely resentful. And, you know, I think there must have been a extreme stratification of society, because you really get different actions of different people that I think are at different levels. You see Sulla, and it's almost like he doesn't understand, it's almost like he doesn't care or doesn't understand, that there's so much resentment being built. You know, and I think that he's viewing things from almost a policy level. You know, and he, you know, not to say that he wasn't a sadist and, you know, someone that's horrible. I mean, if you look at the last moment of his life, you know, one of the last actions he did, you know, he got so infected that he was just apparently festooned with maggots that were eating him alive.
Well, you know, we have
pulling these maggots off of him.
Well, according to Appian's account, he retired in nature and enjoyed the last few years of his life at a sunny, healthy retreat.
Right. Sure.
The, depending on the,
but
depending on what you want to believe, I think Plutarch says that he had this abscess throughout most of his life. He had like these weird birthmarks sort of on his face, and they became infecting throughout his whole body. And you mentioned to me earlier, unfortunately, we weren't recording. He has some guy strangled who owes the Senate money, owes the state money, who supposedly skins him off the top. And he just thought, well, you know, Sol is going to be dead soon anyway, which of course was true. So, you know, he's not going to enforce it. And he has the poor bastard called into his chamber and has him strangled right in front of him.
And apparently he becomes so excited during this strangulation that his abscess bursts open and he bleeds to death.
I know strangulation excites me.
Yeah, I imagine that, when I picture Saul at this point, I picture, you ever seen the movie Dune? And if you've ever seen the movie Dune, there's a guy that's like flying around on a jetpack, like a big fat guy, and he like pulls this dude's heart plug. They have these plugs in their heart and the guy bleeds to death and he's just like grinning in enjoyment of watching this guy die. Yeah, that's how I imagine Saul probably was. He probably took enjoyment out of seeing other people brutally murdered. Like, I really believe that. There was just too many murders. Saul murdered too many people for it to just be political and just be, there was something pathological. And I think you can see that with a lot of the people in Rome. I think too it speaks to a different level of, understanding of what warfare was like. You know, I mean, in modern day warfare, we look at, we even send robots in now. You know, like you have drone combat, but you know, that's a completely different story of when you have to take, you know, an extra long machete and jab it through someone's rib cage till they're dead. You know, and then do that continuously on a battlefield for hours on end. You know, I mean, that's a level of warfare that I don't think probably anyone outside of maybe, you know, Africa, Rwanda, I mean, maybe we've seen that in Rwanda, you know, where there was, you know, machete murders, you know, but I doubt very seriously whether modern period has seen that level of warfare or that intimate of warfare. I mean, that's a level of, there has to be some kind of psychological impact to murdering someone like that and commanding large numbers of people to stab other people to death.
It blows my mind with, you look at the trauma, the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder, we see today with combatants. Yeah. I mean, imagine how many millions, imagine how amplified it was, you know, 2000 years ago where you have to actually run a man through with a decently sharp piece of metal, you know, and then these men are coming home with no knowledge of PTSD, no treatment, no therapy. And they're just, you know, after killing men with swords, you just go right back into society. I mean, it must have just been horrible.
It must have been brutal, not to mention, you know, you might have had to, I mean, you'd have to walk to the battle, which may be on a different continent. You know, can you imagine just like having to like walk from Italy to like, you know, modern day Turkey to like stab someone with a sword and then return home? Like that would be it's a major commitment, you know? I mean, it'd change your life in a way that I don't think anyone you can even concept. Yeah, not to mention having a society with slaves in it. Like I can't imagine having a society where, you know, there's people that could be beat to death with almost impunity, you know, because they're not considered, they're considered property. Yeah, it's really hard for me to conceptualize that kind of world.
What's amazing to me about the slavery?
You have to understand that these are a different world, but I do think Saul probably had a particular enjoyment out of seeing people murdered. That's just my personal opinion. I don't have anything to really back that up, but if you're calling people into your bedroom to be strangled, you probably have a problem. You probably have some sort of mental issue. That needs to be anyway, so basically, before Saul's death,
there's quite a bit of evidence. We mentioned in the last episode, I don't see it in my notes, but I don't think it was a freedman, but one of Sulla's subordinates who had served with him in the war, was quite a favorite of Sulla's. He announced that he was going to run for consul despite being outside the ramifications of Sulla's reconstructed constitution. Remember, we talked about this, and Sulla's like, "Hey, man, you're too young to run for office." And he's like, "Well, I'm going to do it anyway." And Sulla had him murdered in the forum, which brings me to an interesting point about Lepidus, who is an open opponent of Sulla in his legislation and reforms, is of consular age to run in the elections of 79, and Sulla lets him run anyway. And there's no way that Lepidus, there's no way that Lepidus and the dictator were friends, but Sulla doesn't have him murdered. He lets him run for office, and he is elected consul in 79 along with Catulus, who is a big advocate of the Solon regime. I thought we might talk about that in the podcast. Why didn't Sulla do something about letting a man not only run but become elected consul who was openly vocal of him? And we have an account from Sullust where Lepidus gives a pretty hateful speech about Sulla. And, you know, we have every reason to think that Sulla at least was aware that Lepidus was, you know, not flying the Solon colors.
Right, and I think it's really interesting when you really look at Lepidus. I really think there's definitely an anti-Solon element. You know, there's a lot of people who had their families murdered, who've had a lot of their communities destroyed by this Solon revolution, and you can really get a sense of what Lepidus is trying to do from his speech against Sulla, and he's really trying to connect with these elements and trying to connect with a lot of the soldiers that feel like they haven't been justly compensated by the Solon revolution. They feel like they've lost a lot of their freedoms. They've been put at odds with their neighbors and countrymen. So there's definitely a group of people, and I think that's probably why Solon probably could not politically murder him, because Lepidus is one of the few people that is speaking out against this. And if Sulla was trying to kill him, it might have been the feather on the back of the camel. I really do not. Even though we get a larger amount of talk about how Sulla was this just man who was interested in law and really returning Rome to its proper place and proper original constitution, I really think there's probably a political force. He probably knew he could not support the murder of this huge anti-Solon force without risking another civil war. So,
I think he could have, even though he was in retirement, he still had 10,000 freedmen running around Rome. He had veterans settled just north. He still had veterans settled in Italy or in Gaul. I don't think taking care of Lepidus would have been. I don't think he would have had to lift a finger to take care of Lepidus, but I think that he had a need to show that his new constitution was legitimate, that he was going to follow the laws, that it was going to function in his absence, and letting Lepidus, who was not a fan of Sulla, still run and eventually be elected consul was proof that, hey, you know, this is a fair government that I've reorganized. It's not corrupt.
Even still, I would have to retort a little bit on that to say, you know, you still had almost a anti-government in Spain, you know, that was being established by Sertorius. I mean, there was possibly, a large member of the Senate that was against Sulla. So I don't think that it was as much as, you know, Sulla can do. I think Sulla did have, you know, 10,000 freed slaves. He had, like, I think it was 100,000. I don't have the exact figures in front of me. But I think he had something like 100,000 of his diehard veterans in and around Rome. But I think when you really get to it, he had a large number of even the aristocracy, which he was supposed to be supporting, that were vehemently against him, not to mention this huge threat of Sertorius, which was one of the most capable generals of the Roman Empire, positioning himself. Yeah, so I would say that possibly, you know, it's to try to legitimize himself. But I would say more that Saul, because when you look at Saul too, I think Saul gets a huge pass because he's always running out right when there's conflict. He's always making compromises. You know, when Marius, you know, sets, you know, when the, you know, the consoles take over, before, he leaves for the Mithridatic Wars, you know, he just has them promise that they're not going to do anything bad to Rome, and then he, like, runs out, you know, and then he, you know, he really doesn't win the first Mithridatic War. He kind of just brings it to a stalemate.
No, I agree totally with that.
And then he runs back to Rome. And then, you know, even with, you know, these consoles, you know, he just has continuous instances where he just, you know, tells people, now you promised that you're going to play fair, and then he runs away. Like, I think that Sulla, probably didn't have as much clout as we think he did. And I think that's probably why he was doing so much murder, to try to, just intimidate everyone. I think it's really illustrative if we look at Lepidus's speech as Saul gives it. You know, he says, one of the things that he said that he was really doubting that Saul could or even would safely resign. You know, he said, unless you believe that he is now weary or ashamed of his tyranny, and that what he has stolen he will with greater peril relinquish. He called upon all the people to reassert their rights to legislate into the corndole, which Sulla had stopped with his reforms. The Roman people, he scoffed, lately rulers of nations now stripped of power and reputation and rights, without the means to live, an object of contempt, retains not even the ration of slaves.
So, he advocated he promised the people basically to reinstall the corndole, return the exiles that had been exiled through the Saulian regime. And also, I think this is going to play a big role in the Lepidus insurrection, is to give back the misappropriated lands from the inhabitants that Saul settled his veterans on. And I think you're right, though. There is no way he could have gotten these items done without an all out other civil war.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you can really see how Lepidus was positioning himself as a champion of the Italians who had been disenfranchised and dispossessed of the lands for supporting the Marians. You know, in part of the speech, it continues, a great part of the allies and the people of Latium, to whom you gave citizenship in return for many distinguished services, are robbed of it by one man, while a few of his henchmen are rewarded for their crimes and have seized upon the ancestral homes of the blameless people. So he proposed a return of the Marians exiled by Sulla, and a repeal of an iniquitous disenfranchisement of their sons. Yeah, he goes on, for who else in history of the human race has devised such a punishment for those yet unborn? So it was really, you know, I think, and you see Pompey, particularly support Lepidus, which is really interesting because, you know, Sulla and the Metelli are really doing, you know, this huge political maneuvering to bring the power back in the aristocratic domain. But Pompey, who's obviously a part now of the Metelli family, is supporting this anti-Sullan figure, when especially, you know, the one person you expect to be the most pro-Sulla is Pompey himself. You know, because that's where he's derived a lot of his power. But I think you have to also look at what Pompey was doing, is he was really speaking to a lot of his soldiers and constituencies who were who were not Roman; they were Italians.
Well, and why Pompey supported Lepidus is not so much a mystery as you've really got to decide why. When Pompey is elected consul in a few years from now, he is going to reinstitute some of the things that Lepidus is here promising, but maybe he also was supporting Lepidus because if the crazy son of a bitch succeeded with his revolutionary ideas, it was invariably going to require generalship. If it's going to lead to another civil war, like we said, it's going to require some substantial fighting forces. So maybe some people who aren't too particularly fond of Pompey's genuine ideals might think, if I back up Lepidus, I have an opportunity for more military conquest. Or then again, perhaps Pompey did sympathize with some of the ideas of Lepidus.
Yeah, I think you can kind of see almost a history of Pompey siding with almost a popular will. I think he's definitely in that vein, siding with popular will. Especially, you know, his father was extremely unpopular. Pompey's father was extremely unpopular. And you almost see him having to save his father from outright revolt, you know, by appeasing the popular will of the troops. You know, so I think if you kind of take that one step further, he's almost doing the same thing with now with Sulla. You know, he's almost trying to save Sulla from this popular uprising, at least in my kind of interpretation of what's going on. He's almost trying to save Sulla from this kind of revolt, and possibly trying to keep the Republic intact.
Yeah. Right. Maybe it was because of Pompey's support of Sulla, or maybe it was because he disobeyed him and came back from Africa with an army, and he more or less kind of pushed for his triumph that we mentioned in the last episode. But for whatever reason, we have it on good authority that Pompey was completely excluded from Sulla's will.
Yeah. Yeah, because of this so-called Lepidus affair, which, you know, is pretty amazing considering, you know, I think Pompey was one of the reasons why Sulla was able to win the Civil War. You know, and it really goes to show you just what kind of line Pompey was straddling. He was within inside the establishment, which is the Metelli family, but he was really also not of them. He was not truly a part of them. You know, he was a part of them because it convenienced the Metelli family, but he was not part of them because he didn't share the same perspective on the world. You know, so basically, what ends up happening is Lepidus ends up winning the consulship, you know, and Sulla, the consulship of 78, I believe.
78.
You know, Sulla basically lampoons Pompey by saying, "I see, young man, that you rejoice in your victory, for you no doubt consider it a fine and noble thing that Lepidus, who is the worst of men, should have been proclaimed consul by a larger vote than Catulus, who is the best, and all because you used your influence with the people." Sulla then added, "But now it is time for you to wake yourself up and watch your own interests, for you have made a man who is really your enemy stronger than yourself." You definitely see Sulla resenting Pompey. So I definitely doubt if there's any truth to this proclamation of Sulla. I definitely think that it's it shows a split in their interests and a further split inside the Metelli family.
And shortly after Sulla abdicated his dictatorship, you know, he died, like we said. And I also wanted to note that at the funeral, Lepidus was, you know, he was all about, you know, let's just throw this guy in the Tiber. And apparently Pompey, despite receiving nothing in his will, so they were obviously not on good terms with Sulla's death, he still insisted on a state funeral, and he also had the support of Lepidus, who was also, or the support of Catulus, who was also a consul with Lepidus, and Sulla did have a fantastic state funeral, which I don't really want to spend the time describing, but...
Yeah, and Pompey probably had to politically do that, just to stay in good terms with the Metelli family. Like, if he was to literally just dump the body of Sulla into the river, I mean, it probably would have caused another civil war. You know, so I don't know how much of this can really reflect their personal feelings, rather than it reflect the political leanings of the city and the political dynamics they were caught in. After Sulla's death, Lepidus then ends up going to Etruria, modern-day Tuscany, and he basically starts raising troops. He takes his legate, Junius Brutus, to take command there. The Senate tries to buy him off by giving him a province of Transalpine Gaul for his proconsular governorship.
He did clearly break from the Senate, but I wanted to point out, because this is going to play into our episode with the Spanish War, the inhabitants of Gaul had risen up in revolt to try to expel some of Sulla's settled veterans there. So by going there, Lepidus has a chance of getting some recruitment on his side. How do you say? He's also backing up his claims that what Sulla did by resettling the original inhabitants of that land was unjust. And the reason him and Catulus are sent there is because of the uprising trying to expel the Sullan veterans there.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically he puts him with his legate, Junius Brutus, basically start recruiting all these exiled Marians, including, someone that we'll get into later, named Perperna, who is the former governor of Sicily, who had fled before Pompey's original invasion of Sicily on behalf of Sulla. So after he starts doing this, they start holding the consular elections for the following year, and only Catulus returns. Lepidus did not come back. So this was really the red flag to show...
And you're right, he doesn't come back with Catulus. And these people of Etruria is where they were, and he encourages the open rebellion against Rome.
Right. And so you basically get this, this really huge insurrection, coming. And there's really, everyone started looking to Pompey as the solution to the problem. I think you start getting... Ever since, the Battle of Cannae, you keep getting these perpetual calls for one strong man to kind of settle all the problems. And so, the original strong man was Scipio Africanus. Then you had Marius, who's coming to settle things. You had Marius again of the Teutons of Cimbri. Then you had Sulla. And so, it's this continuous process of selecting... people who have had a proven track record to sort of solve all the problems. And in this particular instance... Go ahead.
Some of the interesting elements here I wanted to mention. Right now, our friend Marcus Tullius Cicero, in 79, he had left for Rhodes to study rhetoric, maybe because he had possibly pissed off the dictator Sulla by speaking in court against one of his favorite freedmen. For whatever reason, Cicero's out of the equation here for a couple of years. But we do know that Caesar had returned following Sulla's death, naturally, in 78. And for whatever reason, he refused to throw in his lot here with this Lepidus revolution. And I have it on good authority that Caesar was a revolutionary. And perhaps the reasons Caesar didn't throw in his lots with Lepidus, and he definitely would have sympathized, I feel, and you can feel free to dispute me, with some of his political ideals, but perhaps the reason he didn't throw in his lot with him is because I don't think Lepidus had a lot of confidence in himself here in 78, because instead of going right to the armed revolution, he starts to insist on programs of reforms. That is the rights of the tribunes to be restored, the return of confiscated property, the recall of the exiles, and the redistribution of the corn dole.
Yeah, and so... I think you start seeing, obviously Catulus, who's now the proconsul, he's basically ready to fight, as was Appius Claudius, who is the interrex, which is it was kind of a throwback to the ancient monarchy. When Rome didn't have any elected consuls, they basically appointed an interrex, which was a king of the for 5 days. So that person was Appius Claudius, who filled in that position when Lepidus didn't return. And so you also start getting, obviously Cicero's out of the picture, but Pompey's old friend Lucius Philippus starts entreating the Senate on Pompey's behalf, to, you know, if we remember this, Lucius Philippus was the same guy that really spoke on Pompey's behalf when he was accused by the Martin regime of misappropriating booty from Asculum during the social war, or during the Italian war, the social war. So he basically started trying to persuade the Senate to issue that ultimate decree that we've heard about, proclaiming that state of emergency, to authorize Catulus and Appius Claudius to see to it that no harm shall befall the Republic.
I can only assume that the paralysis of the Senate here is because they did not want another civil war.
Right, yeah. Obviously, the Senate, they just went through a massive civil war. They're probably really on edge. They probably don't know who's going to win. I mean, right now, you're looking at a Rome that had basically been destroyed by a person that marched on it from the outside, and now Lepidus is positioning himself to march on it again. And obviously, we saw what Sulla did when he re-entered the city, which is murder everyone. So the Senate probably did not want to make enemies, seeing as Lepidus was about to march on Rome with a large number of Gauls and disenfranchised Marians.
So the Senate basically told him to come back to preside over the elections for the next consul, which was the traditional for the present consuls to do. And when Lepidus refused, he withdrew northwards to Etruria, and he decided to raise more troops, which were going to be needed if he wanted to take over Rome and Italy. And like you said, Marcus Philippus had persuaded the Senate to take action. Pompey was duly summoned and immediately sent north, recruiting out of Picenum in Gaul, which is Pompey's recruiting ground. Pompey's plan was to cut communications by land between Etruria and Transalpine Gaul and Spain, and at all costs prevent reinforcements from joining Lepidus. We can speculate why Pompey took the command against Lepidus when he previously supported him. He obviously, as we'll see during his consulship, could sympathize with his measures.
Right, and he also has large holdings in Picenum and Gaul, which obviously the Gauls that had been divested of their land, which was given to the Sullans, obviously were probably pretty angry with him.
And I think it's clear that Pompey had no revolutionary tendency, otherwise he would have taken them. But I also think part of the reason why he was so eager to take up arms against Lepidus, other than to further his military glory, is that I think Pompey had ideas about what was going on with the situation in Spain. And if he could topple Lepidus, then that would give him a good opportunity. That would put him in a good position to be selected to be the general who can go to Spain and deal with the Sertorius threat, which is becoming a huge issue in Spain.
Right. And also, if you think about it, if Lepidus was positioning himself as a champion of Gaul by eliminating Lepidus, he basically fulfills that position. You know, he basically becomes the Gallic ruler, you know, and so you see, you know, I think there's a multiple different angles. You know, obviously Pompey's been amassing large clientele in Sicily. There's a lot of the corn supplies coming from, you know, so he's starting to position himself with clientele in the most important areas of Rome. He goes to Mutina, he destroys, laid siege to Brutus, Brutus surrenders, and basically Lepidus is cut off from any reinforcements from the north. So basically once Pompey writes to the Senate that Brutus has surrendered, there's a huge sigh of relief, and Pompey is basically hailed as the savior of Rome at this point. So it's kind of interesting that Pompey then, after he sends the letter, he then dispatches someone to murder Brutus, who is the captor, which is really scorned at by the Senate because he didn't really have the authority to murder a legate of a standing consul from the Senate. So it's interesting.
I have a couple sources here that say that it was just outright treachery of Pompey, that he sent word to the Senate that he had surrendered, then he changed his mind and decided to kill him. I also have some pretty good sources that say, you know, Brutus had surrendered and Pompey magnanimously had let him go with some of his officers and a contingent of horse, and he just goes to the very next town and starts recruiting all over again. So Pompey had no choice,
right?
But to put.
So it may have just been propaganda.
Yeah. All right. So afterwards, Lepidus was summoned by the Senate, and he did not return, but he appeared with his entire force.
And basically, Lepidus starts to march on Rome. Yeah. And he makes some pretty good progress. He's advancing across the, I believe he makes it past the, or he makes it past the Janiculum, right? But then he's turned back on the Campus Martius.
And he demands, and he essentially demands of the Senate a second consulship. And this is amazing here, that the Senate, they actually neutralize Lepidus' support by electing relatives of both Brutus and Lepidus, Aemilius Lepidus and D. Junius Brutus as consuls for that year.
Yeah.
Which was, sorry, they have a pretty bad history of being pretty paralyzed and foolish, but that was pretty shrewd maneuvering by electing relatives of the insurrectionists as consuls for the next year. First, the Senate is hesitant in attacking Lepidus, but again, this Philippus character persuaded them again. Also, there was a letter from Pompey that he had just defeated Brutus. So, with the reassurance that Brutus had been defeated, and again with the assurance of Philippus and the persuading of Philippus, the Senate finally did attack Lepidus. They were hesitant to defend a city, and it was probably because they lacked confidence. But though Catulus was by all accounts ready to go, and it wasn't really until they heard of Pompey's victory that they got the confidence to fight off.
I remember that they made it through the Janiculum, but they couldn't make it through the Campus Martius. So he actually almost, Lepidus almost, without reinforcements, marched on Rome successfully. But he ended up being subordinated. Yeah, and basically, so Lepidus is defeated, he's exiled to Sardinia, and we're told his wife cheats on him, and then he dies of a broken heart, or something like that. So, nothing too fancy happens to Lepidus. And then you talked about how they elected these consuls that were relatives, which were really, it was literally just a political tool. And then, you know, they order Pompey to disband his army and return home. But Pompey has other thoughts in mind. Philippus starts, you know, trying to secure a position, to assist Metellus Pius as a proconsul. So, essentially, Metellus Pius at this time is probably the most powerful man in Rome. And to be his proconsul, to be on the same footing, basically, as Metellus Pius, in Spain, is going to be a huge, huge feather in Pompey's hat. So Pompey starts leveraging his position with an army, after Rome has just suffered one major attack. You know, basically Pompey's posing an extreme threat, especially since he now controls most of the area of Gaul and Picenum. Pompey could have easily just turned, marched on Rome, and assumed control, especially with Metellus Pius being outside of Rome.
And when Pompey was coming down from Etruria to intercept Lepidus, he had hoped to get him trapped between him and Catulus, and of course Lepidus was already defeated. And I did want to mention, I know this is off, I know this is kind of out of order, but after Lepidus died, his lieutenant Perperna decided to take up command with the remaining troops, and he sailed to Spain to join with Sertorius. And we have good evidence that we believe that the ships at Cosa, where Lepidus escaped on the coast, was supplied by Sertorius or the Cilician pirates, who were likely in league with Sertorius.
So, you basically get this interesting dynamic. I really think that you're not going to find such a unique and in-depth analysis of the political scene covering this affair. A lot of times, what really frustrates me about a lot of the things that I've read about Pompey is that he's viewed as someone who's politically inept because he is not playing these power political games, when really, I think he's fairly politically astute. I mean, I think for one person, I really don't think that you're really seeing the full dynamics of his basically opening moves on the political scene in this kind of light. So I think we're definitely, if you're listening to this, you're getting a very unique perspective from which to approach a reading of the fall of the Roman Republic. Next time we're going to see the war in Spain. We're really going to see the juvenile butcher get schooled by probably one of the best generals Rome has ever had. Sertorius is potentially on par with a Scipio Africanus, and it's going to take someone like Pompey, along with the other most powerful man in Rome, to really bring him down. So you'll get some of that and more in the next installment of Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.